listeners, welcome to The Book Reports. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm honored to dedicate this show to our men and women in uniform. We'll be previewing titles that offer up a salute to Veterans Day, military history, fiction, and notable new books that focus on our country's history. Let's get started as we turn to page one of The Book Report. The modern classic, The Things They Carried, was a finalist for both the 1990 Pulitzer Prize and National Book Critics Circle Award. It's a stunning portrayal of the boots-on-the-ground experience of soldiers in the Vietnam War. Now, three-time Emmy Award winner Bryan Cranston, you know him as Walter White of Breaking Bad, delivers an electrifying performance of the book. The soldiers in this collection of stories carried M16 rifles, M79 grenade launchers, plastic explosives, hand grenades, and letters from home, illustrated Bibles, and pictures of loved ones. Every man carried what he needed to survive. Those who made it home carried their shattering stories away from the jungle and back to a nation that could somehow never truly understand.
In the first week of April, before Lavender died, Lieutenant Jimmy Cross received a good luck charm from Martha. It was a simple pebble, an ounce at most. Smooth to the touch, it was a milky white color with flecks of orange and violet, oval-shaped, like a miniature egg. In the accompanying letter, Martha wrote that she had found the pebble on the Jersey shoreline, precisely where the land touched the water at high tide, where things came together but also separated. It was this separate but together quality, she wrote, that had inspired her to pick up the pebble and to carry it in her breast pocket for several days, where it seemed weightless, and then send it through the mail by air as a token of her truest feelings for him. Lieutenant Cross found this romantic, but he wondered what her truest feelings were exactly, and what she meant by separate but together. He wondered how the tides and waves had come into play on that afternoon along the Jersey shoreline when Martha saw the pebble and bent down to rescue it from geology. He imagined bare feet. Martha was a poet with a poet's sensibilities, and her feet would be brown and bare, the toenails unpainted, the eyes chilly and somber like the ocean in March. And though it was painful, he wondered who had been with her that afternoon. He imagined a pair of shadows moving along the strip of sand where things came together but also separated. It was phantom jealousy, he knew, but he couldn't help himself. He loved her so much. On the march through the hot days of early April, he carried the pebble in his mouth, turning it with his tongue, tasting sea salt and moisture. His mind wandered. He had difficulty keeping his attention on the war. On occasion, he would yell out to his men to spread out the column, to keep their eyes open. But then he would slip away into daydreams, just pretending, walking barefoot along the Jersey shore with Martha, carrying nothing. He would feel himself rising, sun and waves and gentle winds, all love and lightness. What they carried varied by mission. When a mission took them to the mountains, they carried mosquito netting, machetes, canvas tarps, and extra bug juice. If a mission seemed especially hazardous, or if it involved a place they knew to be bad, they carried everything they could. In certain heavily mined AOs, where the land was dense with toe poppers and bouncing betties, they took turns humping a 28-pound mine detector. With its headphones and its big sensing plate, the equipment was a stress on the lower back and shoulders, awkward to handle, often useless because of the shrapnel in the earth. But they carried it anyway, partly for safety, partly for the illusion of safety. On ambush or other night missions, they carried peculiar little odds and ends. Kiowa always took along his New Testament and a pair of moccasins for silence. Dave Jensen carried night sight vitamins high in carotene. Lee Strunk carried his slingshot. Ammo, he claimed, would never be a problem. Rat Kiley carried brandy and M&M's candy. Until he was shot, Ted Lavender carried the Starlight Scope, which weighed 6.3 pounds with its aluminum carrying case. Henry Dobbins carried his girlfriend's pantyhose wrapped around his neck as a comforter. They all carried ghosts. When dark came, they would move out single file across the meadows and paddies to their ambush coordinates, where they would quietly set up the claymores and lie down and spend the night waiting.
We've just heard The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. Few journalists have reckoned with the psychology of war as intimately as David Finkel. In The Good Soldiers, his best-selling account from the front lines of Baghdad, Finkel shadowed the men of the 216 Infantry Battalion as they carried out the infamous surge. Now, Finkel has followed some of the same men as they've returned home and struggled to reintegrate, both into their family lives and into American society at large. In Thank You for Your Service, Finkel writes with compassion about the soldiers and their wives and children. Where do soldiers belong after their homecoming? Is it possible or even reasonable to expect them to rejoin their communities as if nothing has happened? And in moments of hardship, who can soldiers turn to when they feel alienated? Arthur Bishop performs this tale of the brave but shaken men of the 216.
She found an organization willing to pay for his car repairs, has gotten him free turkeys at Thanksgiving, and meets with him every so often to see what else she might do. Likes to hunt and fish. That's his therapy, she wrote about him once in her field notes. And so when she hears about an all-expenses-paid pheasant hunt that is being organized in western Kansas for combat wounded soldiers, she thinks of him right away. Healing heroes, healing families, the flyer promoting the hunt says. 3 nights of lodging and 2 days of hunting. Spouse downtown pampering excursion. Children funathon. Advised on pheasant hunt, Patty writes in her notes after telling Adam about it. And a week later, Adam, Saskia, Zoe, and Jackson are in the car headed west. It's a 250-mile drive, and 30 minutes into it, as they're passing through Abilene, home of Dwight D. Eisenhower, president and war hero, Adam turns on the radio. Saskia reaches forward and changes the station. Adam looks at her and changes it back. Saskia shoots him a look and changes it back. And that's all it takes. The fight gets so bad so quickly that Adam pulls a U-turn and guns it back to Junction City. She is screaming at him to get help or get out of her life forever. He drives off. He doesn't know where else to go, so he gets back on the highway. 4 hours later, checked into the hotel, thoughts creeping back into his mind of wanting his life to be over, he gathers with the other wounded soldiers and their families in a conference room for welcoming speeches and receives his first gift of the weekend. A shotgun? He thinks as he sees the box. Really? Back in his room, he removes it from the box and assembles it so he'll be ready to go in the morning, and things slide downhill from there. He sets his alarm. He asks someone to wake him up just in case. He doesn't hear his alarm. No one knocks on his door. He gets to the hunt 2 hours late and sees more people than he expected. Who are they, he wonders, his mood darkening even more. Volunteers? Sponsors? Those people who drive around with "We Support the Troops" signs on their cars, as if a sign on a car makes any difference. The ones who have never been to war and will never go to war and say to soldiers, "Thank you for your service," with their gooey eyes and orthodontist smiles. They're certainly not hunters, not the way they're wandering around, and look at them now, fawning over the soldiers with visible injuries, the one with gunshot scars, the amputee. And here come the inevitable thoughts. Those soldiers are injured, he's not. They're wounded warriors, and he's weak. He stands off by himself. He talks to no one. He has lost the capacity to see that his behavior is the behavior of the wounded. At some point, a few pheasants rise into the air, and when a dozen guns begin blasting away, he decides he's had enough. He goes back to the hotel, packs in a fury, and leaves, and soon he is back in Junction City. Home again. And once again, he has a shotgun. I can't pay my rent. I ran out of meds. I haven't gotten my pay. Patty Walker is reading the messages waiting for her at the start of a new day. She sighs. She is a big sigher. although that may come with a job described as soldier family advocate on the business cards she hands out to soldiers, which also include the promise, for as long as it takes. He's burned, she keeps reading. He needs clothes for the summertime. His wife doesn't speak English. How am I going to get her a job? She is a talker, too, and a hugger, and as Saskia once said of Amanda Doster, she can put on the waterworks like that. Unlike Amanda, though, who is defined so much by sorrow, Patty is defined by the stress of dealing with the problems of 49 wounded soldiers during the day, 49 Adams is one way to think of it, and then going home at night to the 50th. This is her husband, Kevin, who was blown up in Iraq.
We have just heard Thank You for Your Service by David Finkel. The acclaimed author Simon Winchester delivers his first book about America, The Men Who United the States, America's Explorers, Inventors, Eccentrics, and Mavericks, and the Creation of One Nation Indivisible. This fascinating popular history illuminates the men who toiled fearlessly to discover, connect, and bond the citizenry and geography of the USA. How did America become one nation indivisible? What unified a growing number of disparate states into the modern country we recognize today? To answer these questions, Winchester, who narrates, follows in the footsteps of America's most essential explorers, thinkers, and innovators, such as Lewis and Clark, the builders of the first transcontinental telegraph, and the powerful civil engineer behind the interstate highway system. He treks from Pittsburgh to Portland, Rochester to San Francisco, Seattle to Anchorage, to bring us the fascinating people who played a pivotal role in creating today's United States.
Charles Lyell, the Scotsman who 20 years earlier had written his famous Principles of Geology, had boated down these same rivers and had written two books of his American travels with which Powell was familiar. The young man did much the same as Lyell, exploring, observing and collecting, on the way amassing impressive numbers of rock specimens and fossils. So assiduous was he that he won an Illinois State Prize for his glass cases of mollusks. Publicly, he was little troubled by having his arm shot off. Wallace Stegner, writing in 1954, captured Powell's insouciance perfectly. It affected Wes Powell's life about as much as a stone fallen into a swift stream affects the course of the river. He saw action in 9 further set-piece battles, from Cherupini Hill to Vicksburg, before retiring from the army with the rank of major, which he'd use for the rest of his civilian life. That was in 1865. Later that same year, he took up the post of geology professor at a college in Bloomington, Illinois, and by Christmas was already dreaming of taking his students on a collecting expedition into the Rocky Mountains and further west, mainly to find items to put in the glass cases of the university museum. 2 years later, the pivotal year, 1867, he decided that his planned adventure positively deserved some help from the government that he had served in wartime. So he went to Washington, fighting his way through the crowds of other seekers of federal favor, all of them behaving like rutting stags, as he put it, and eventually secured from his old commanders the promise of army rations for his party, even a military escort if he'd agree to take his students collecting in the Sioux territories in the Dakota Badlands. But crucially, he ignored this second offer, for his old friend General William Tecumseh Sherman of the famous March Through Georgia advised him otherwise. He should not go to the Dakotas at all. Instead of stirring up trouble among the Sioux of the Northern Plains, the understandably war-weary general told him he should head south and probe the abundant mysteries of the Rockies of Colorado. Sherman's advice changed Powell's life. It was a choice that set him on the path to win a reputation as perhaps the preeminent soldier-scientist explorer of his day. For Powell and his men would in time head down into the Colorado River, and they would journey, for the first time any white men had done such a thing, from one end to the formidable other of that most immense natural wonder, the Grand Canyon. The epic journey was formally named the Rocky Mountain Scientific Exploring Expedition, and was technically not one of the 4 great surveys, though its eventual success was the reason Powell was subsequently selected as leader of one of them. But success was by no means guaranteed, and in the planning of the expedition, no sponsor was either especially enthusiastic or particularly generous. Aside from the promised army rations, food for 12 to be drawn from Western army posts, cash to be given if rations were not available, Powell's only quasi-official support came from the Illinois State History Society and a local university. The Smithsonian Institution gave him some scientific equipment, the Chicago Academy of Sciences a little more. Otherwise, he was on his own, and such men as agreed to come with him went essentially as volunteers, for there was almost no money to pay them. Not surprisingly, given such exigencies, it took him and his team some while, two full seasons, in fact, to put together the expedition and then to accomplish its intended mission. During the first season, Powell and his party, which would be steadily winnowed and trimmed to the 6 men who made it all the way, made their preparations and consolidated their friendships with the local Ute Indians. It was while the party was surveying and mapping the White and the Green Rivers, major tributaries of the Colorado, that the Ute gave him the name Caporatz. There was nothing poetic about it. It meant quite starkly, arm off. After a first winter spent in a frigid campsite and a good deal of throat-clearing, including another trip back to Washington by Powell to beg for a little more financial help, and then a diversion to Chicago to have proper boats built, the party set off.
That was The Men Who United the States by Simon Winchester. Sandra Brown began her writing career in 1981 and has since published over 70 novels. In 2008, Sandra was named Thriller Master, the top award given by the International Thriller Writers Association. Among her other honors, Sandra received the Romance Writers of America's Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2011, she and four colleagues went on a week-long USO tour to Afghanistan, meeting with service members on numerous bases. Sandra is the current president of the Mystery Writers of America. Today, we'll speak with Sandra about her wonderful new book, Deadline. Welcome, Sandra. It's a thrill to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you, Elaine. I'm very happy to be here.
Deadline is based on an FBI cold case. How did you decide to have this at the core of the story?
It was sort of an accident. Actually, I was on the FBI website doing research on another thing, and I saw one of the selections was the 10 Most Wanted, and I thought, well, that'll be interesting. So I clicked on that, and I was scrolling through it, reading about all these nefarious men and women. And I noticed that some of them had been at large for, like, decades, and their crimes dated back, to the 80s, 70s. And I thought, my word, how does someone stay hidden that long and often in plain sight? And so that just kind of sparked the idea to use a crime that was decades old. And then it kind of dovetailed with my idea of Dawson Scott and his returning from Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress, which is sadly a topic on everyone's mind. And so the two just kind of merged into Deadline.
Right. Well, introduce us to the incredibly cool and, I believe, pretty damn sexy Dawson Scott.
Well, thank you. He's supposed to be. Well, he is a journalist. He writes for a news magazine. And for the past 9 months, he's been in Afghanistan covering stories from the war zone. And it occurred to me, we hear a lot about service members returning from Afghanistan and other fronts with post-traumatic stress, but we don't hear a lot about civilians, and yet there are so many people serving in one capacity or another. When I and a group of colleagues did a USO tour in 2011, we were really surprised by the number of civilians we met who go over there as contractors or vendors or medical personnel. And I thought, well, they're subject to the same threat, life threats every day that they're there. And so I thought it would be interesting to take it from that point of view, that it would be someone who comes home and no one would expect him to be suffering the symptoms that he is. And, of course, one of the symptoms is that the one that's afflicted with it tries to hide the symptoms. So that's what Dawson is trying to do when the story opens.
Right. I loved how you incorporated the diary of one of the characters in the story. It offered such a unique perspective. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, Elaine and Deadline, I had, as we've talked about, a long period of time to cover from the initial crime that was committed in the late 1970s to the present day, which equates to almost 40 years. And I thought, how can I impart this information to the reader without it just being, you know, dull reading? Try to think of a device that I could use. And I thought, what if it's diary entries and they're short? They're written in first person, which is the first time I've ever published anything in first person. And they're really written in the voice of the character. And she doesn't appear in any other part of the book, but she gives us insight into what the life was like and the character, not only of her, but of a villain.
Well, you got your start writing romance novels. What was the transition to thrillers like for you, and what special tools did you bring along?
Well, it was a difficult and an easy transition, which sounds kind of contradictory, but that's exactly the way it was. It was easy for me to decide that I wanted to start writing books with more suspenseful content, and I wanted to write books that, you know, the plot dealt with more than just the love story. So for me, the transition was easy. From a marketing standpoint, it was rather difficult, because once the publishing industry and readers put you in a certain pigeonhole, they're sometimes reluctant, you know, for you to change. They want the same old, but different.
Yeah.
It was a conundrum, but I really did want to move into a genre that would enable me to cultivate a larger reading audience. I wanted to expand my readership. I wanted to cross gender. I wanted to cross generations, and so I started writing books with more and more and more suspenseful, you know, content. And thankfully, the reading audience gravitated with me, and so here I am today.
Right. Well, you always do a fabulous job of blending romance into the story. How do your male readers respond?
Oh, I think they love it, because I was asked recently, how do you combine the two, and why do you think it works for the two to be combined? For me, it seems natural. For me, it seems like it should be that way, because no one is ever more afraid than when a loved one is threatened. I mean, even, you know, a mother will stand in front of a bus to protect her child, or husband and wife, you know, will sacrifice themselves for the sake of the other. So our fear is never heightened more than when someone we love is threatened. So in that way, in the books, the suspense deepens the level of the emotion, and the emotional pull, gravitation, love, whatever you want to call it, for the other human being ratchets up the stakes of the suspense. So I think they feed off each other, and I think they feed each other. I think they fuel each other. So the suspense and the love story that's growing just seem a natural combination to me.
Well, I think your readers, millions of readers would agree.
Well, thank you.
On a totally different note, what's it like to be president of the Mystery Writers of America, and what are your duties?
It's wonderful, because you have no duties whatsoever.
Okay.
No, actually, I say that facetiously, but truthfully, it really is an honorary post. The administration is run by a paid administrator, and then there are elected officers who really work from the trenches, and they really do all of the work. So it is more of an honor. The one thing that is asked of the incoming president is to preside over or MC the Edgar's Award Dinner. Now, this is a dinner that is attended by usually about 1,000 writers, agents, publishing people from the book world, film world, TV. It's everybody. And so it's rather intimidating to get up there that night and try to be clever and try to move things along, because it's always on a weeknight, and so they want you to, you know, get everybody, since it's a school night, get everybody out of there fairly early. So it's up to the incoming president to host that banquet. And so that can be kind of you know, a nerve-wracking chore, but it's a great deal of fun, too. And the audience is forgiving. I think there's a certain empathy.
So what's next for you?
Well, I'm already at work on another book. I just had the... I sent in a rough synopsis because I don't know what's going to happen. Don't know everything that's going to happen. But I let my reader know the main thing and what the book is going to be about and who the main characters are and so forth and what their main problem is. And I just got her green light to proceed. So I'm in the first draft of the next book. So maybe next year we'll be talking about it.
I hope so. Well, I've so enjoyed our conversation today. Any final thoughts?
Oh, I just want everyone to read Deadline. I think this is a book especially men would enjoy, as well as women, because the most of the book is written from the main character's point of view, and the main character is Dawson Scott, and he's got so many levels and so many things he's dealing with. I think he's a very relatable character, and I think the surprise at the end is one of the best surprises I've ever pulled, and everyone who's read it says, oh my gosh, did not see that coming, which of course is what a novelist wants to hear. So I think it's a enjoyable read for anyone who just likes a big, fat, juicy, entertaining book.
Well, I want to share that I sat down on Sunday afternoon and I read that book cover to cover,
because
I could not put it down. Sandra, thanks so much for joining us today. I love the book.
Well, thanks, Elaine. I appreciate your having me.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Deadline, narrated by Stephen Lang.
One of their arms suppliers, who was well known to the authorities for his criminal history, had been placed under surveillance for suspicion of an arms deal unrelated to the Rangers of Righteousness. He had made 3 trips to the abandoned house in Golden Branch over the course of that many weeks. A telephoto lens had caught him talking to a man later identified as Carl Wingert, leader of the Rangers. When this was reported to the FBI, ATF, and U.S. Marshals Service, the agencies immediately sent personnel, who continued to monitor the illegal weapons dealer. Upon his return from a visit to Golden Branch, he was arrested. It took 3 days of persuasion, but under advice of counsel, he made a deal with the authorities and gave up what he knew about the people holed up inside the abandoned house. He'd only met with Carl Wingert. He couldn't, or wouldn't, say who else was sequestered with Wingert, or how long they planned to harbor there. Fearing that if they didn't move swiftly, they'd miss their opportunity to capture one of the FBI's most wanted, the federal agents enlisted help from the local authorities, who also had outstanding warrants for members of the group. The team was assembled, and the operation planned. But it became immediately obvious to each member of the team that Wingert's band had meant what they'd said about choosing death over capture. The Rangers of Righteousness wanted to secure their place in history. There would be no laying down of arms, no hands raised in peaceful surrender. The lawmen were pinned down behind trees or vehicles, and all were vulnerable. Even a flicker of motion drew gunfire, and members of the Rangers had proven themselves to be excellent shots. The resident agent in charge, Emerson, radioed the operations post, requesting that a helicopter be sent to provide them air cover, but that idea was nixed because of the inclement weather. Special ops teams from local, state, and federal agencies were mobilized, but they would be driving to Golden Branch, and the roads weren't ideal even in good weather. The team were told to stand by and to fire only in self-defense, while men in safe, warm offices debated changing the rules of engagement to include using deadly force. "They're playing patty cake because one of them is a woman," Emerson groused to Headley. "And God forbid we violate these killers' civil rights. Nobody admires or respects us, you know." Headley, the rookie of the team, wisely held his own counsel. "We're feds, and even before Watergate, government had become a dirty word." Emerson had a military background and a decidedly hawkish viewpoint, but nobody, especially not he, wanted a bloodbath that morning. Nobody got what they wanted. While the reinforcements were still en route, the Rangers amped up their firepower. An ATF agent took a bullet in the thigh, and, from the way it was bleeding, it was feared his femoral artery had suffered damage, the extent of which was unknown, but on any scale, it was a life-threatening wound. Emerson reported this with a spate of obscenities about their being picked off one by effing one unless he was given the authorization to engage. Return fire from the house decreased, then became sporadic. Emerson ordered a ceasefire. They waited. Suddenly, bleeding from several wounds, including a head wound, a man charged through the front door, screaming invectives and spraying rounds from his own submachine gun. It was a suicidal move, and he knew it. His reason for doing it would soon become apparent. When the agents ceased firing and their ears stopped ringing, they realized that the house had fallen eerily silent except for a loose shutter that clapped against an exterior wall whenever the wind caught it. After a tense 60 seconds, Emerson said, "I'm going in." He levered himself up into a crouch as he replaced his spent clip magazine with a fresh one. Headley did the same. "I'm with you."
That was a sampling of Deadline by Sandra Brown. W.E.B. Griffin is one of the masters of military fiction. Retreat, hell! Book 10 in the Core series begins in the fall of 1950. The Marines have made a pivotal breakthrough at Incheon, but a roller coaster awaits them. Douglas MacArthur is intent on surging across the 38th parallel toward the Yalu River, where he is certain no Chinese are waiting for him, while Major Ken McCoy, operating undercover, hears a very different story. Meanwhile, Brigadier General Fleming Pickering, shuttling between two continents, works desperately to mediate the escalating battle between MacArthur and President Harry Truman, while trying to keep his mind from the cold fact that somewhere out there, his own daredevil pilot son, Pick, is lost behind enemy lines. Dick Hill performs the story.
Captain John C. Allen III, a somewhat plump, pleasant-faced 27-year-old who was commanding officer of Company C, 1st Battalion, 27th Infantry, 7th Infantry Division, was hesitantly pleased with his current mission, the establishment and operation of a roadblock on a road south of Suwon. You never knew what the hell was going to happen next in the Army. Disappointment, sometimes bitter, was always just around the corner. He had been told, and he had believed, that it would be days, perhaps weeks, before he actually had to face the enemy. The landing of 10th Corps, the 1st Marine Division and the 7th Infantry Division, at Incheon had severed the enemy supply routes to the south. Without supplies, the North Koreans could not maintain their attack on the Pusan perimeter. The 8th U.S. Army had already counterattacked, broken out of the perimeter, and was driving the enemy northward. There was still heavy action around Seoul, but most of that was being fought by the 1st Marine Division. Allen thought that the brass had at least enough sense to realize that the 7th Division really was in no shape to fight anybody. Any military unit needs training to be effective. It was Captain Allen's professional judgment that none of the platoons in his company had adequate training. Neither had any of the companies in the 1st Battalion, any of the battalions in the 27th Infantry, nor any of the regiments in the 7th Division. It was also Captain Allen's professional opinion that if the 1st Marine Division hadn't performed so superbly, if it had taken a licking, the 7th Division would have really gotten itself clobbered. Captain Allen was perfectly happy to form, and to sometimes offer to select individuals, such as 1st Sergeant Grass, professional opinions about the military, although he was not a career officer, had not graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point, nor, for that matter, attended the company-grade officer's course at the infantry school at Fort Benning. He hadn't even gone to officer candidate school. Drafted at 20 during World War II, Jack Allen had joined the 26th Infantry of the 1st Infantry Division in North Africa. By the time the Big Red One was training to land on the beaches of Normandy, it was Staff Sergeant Allen. On D+3 in Normandy, it was 21-year-old Second Lieutenant Allen, holder of the Silver Star and directly commissioned after taking over the company when the officers had all been either blown away or wounded. When war in Europe was over, Captain Jack Allen, who had added 2 Bronze Stars and 2 Purple Hearts to his Silver Star, had been one of the very first officers returned to the United States under the point system for separation. At Fort Dix, he had made the mistake of believing the Adjutant General's Corps Major, who had told him that if he kept his commission in the reserve, he wouldn't be recalled to active duty unless and until enemy tanks were rolling down Pennsylvania Avenue toward the White House. Jack Allen, star salesman and heir apparent to the throne of J.C. Allen & Sons Paper Merchants, Inc., Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, had received a telegram from the Adjutant General of the United States Army on 9 July 1950, ordering him to report within 72 hours to Camp Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, there to enter upon extended active duty for the duration of the present conflict, plus 6 months. At Indiantown Gap, there was just time enough to buy uniforms and have his shot record brought up to date before being loaded on a battered Douglas C-54 and flown to Fort Lewis, Washington. 3 days after arriving at Fort Lewis, he boarded a brand-new-looking Lockheed Constellation of Transglobal Airways and was flown to Tokyo via Honolulu and Wake Island. At Camp Drake, he was assigned to the 7th Division. When he got there, they didn't seem to know what to do with him. He was given one assignment after another, one of them lasting 6 hours, but finally he found himself in the 27th Infantry Regiment. There, the colonel commanding, who looked smart and competent, if harried, took a 60-second look at Jack's service record. "Jesus Christ," he thought. "They finally sent me a company commander who's been in combat." Then he said, "Congratulations, Captain Allen. You are now commanding officer of Charlie Company." When Allen found his new command, in a battered frame barracks building, the acting first sergeant, a technical sergeant who a week before had been running an NCO club, told him Charlie Company's total strength was 2 officers and 26 enlisted men, plus 13 enlisted men listed as absent in confinement. The other officer was Second Lieutenant C. Danton Foster IV, who looked to be about 19, but who told Allen he had graduated just over a year before from West Point. When Allen looked at Foster's service record, he saw that he was unmarried and listed his next of kin as Major General C. Danton Foster III.
We've just heard Retreat Hell by W.E.B. Griffin. Scott Anderson's Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East is a revelatory narrative of one of the most epic periods of the 20th century. The Arab revolt against the Turks in World War I was, in the words of T.E. Lawrence, a sideshow of a sideshow. As a result, the conflict was shaped to a remarkable degree by a small handful of adventurers and low-level officers far removed from the corridors of power. Kurt Prüfer was an academic attached to the German embassy in Cairo. Aaron Aronson was a renowned agronomist and a committed Zionist. William Yale was a fallen scion of the American aristocracy who traveled the Ottoman Empire on behalf of Standard Oil. And at the center of it all was Lawrence. In early 1914, he was an archaeologist excavating in Syria. By 1917, he was riding into legend at the head of an Arab army as he fought a rearguard action against his own government and its imperial ambitions. Based on 4 years of research, Lawrence in Arabia offers a clear, sensible look at the causes and course of the First World War, as well as an understanding of the making of the modern Middle East. Malcolm Hilgartner performs the book.
"I think it time I dedicated a letter to you," Thomas Edward Lawrence wrote his father on August 20th, 1906. although it does not make the least difference in style, since all my letters are equally bare of personal information. The buildings I try to describe will last longer than we will, so it is only fitting that they should have the greater space." True to his word, Lawrence spent the rest of that letter imparting absolutely no information about himself, not even bothering to mention how he had spent his 18th birthday 4 days earlier. Instead, he used the space to describe in minute detail the structural peculiarities of a 14th-century castle he had just visited. Lawrence, on recess from the Oxford High School for Boys, was spending that summer bicycling through northwestern France. The bicycle had only recently become widely available to the European general public, a result of design innovations and mass production, and it had sparked something of a craze among the British middle class for cycling tours of the European countryside. Lawrence's trip was on a wholly different scale, however. A nearly 1,000-mile trek that took him to most every notable castle and cathedral in the Normandy region. The notes he took of these places form the basis of Lawrence's letters to his family back in Oxford. While he often prefaced them with brief expressions of concern for his mother's purportedly frail health, the chief characteristic of most of his correspondence was its utter impersonality, the same disquisitional tone as adopted in that to his father. In some respects, this element of emotional constriction was probably not unusual for a member of a British middle-class family at the end of the Victorian age. It may have been heightened in the Lawrence household by its male preponderance, a family of 5 boys and no girls, but this was a segment of society that prized self-control and understatement, where children were expected to be studious and respectful, and where a parent's greatest gift to those children was not an indulgent affection, but rather a sober religious grounding and a good education. It was also a segment of society that held to a simple and comfortable worldview. While radical political ideas were starting to find flower among the working class, the British middle class still adhered to a social hierarchy based less on attained wealth than on ancestry and accent, a caste system that rigidly dictated nearly every aspect of social life, in some respects even more rigidly than a half century before. If stultifying, this stratification also meant that everyone knew his place, the station in life to which he might reasonably aspire. To the degree possible, social and economic advancement was obtained through the godly virtues of modesty, self-reliance, diligence, and thrift. Perhaps the least questioned tenet of the time was the notion that the British Empire now stood at the very apex of modern civilization, and that it was the special burden of this empire to spread its enlightenment, whether through commerce, the Bible, the gun, or some combination of all three, to the world's less fortunate cultures and races. While this conviction extended to all segments of British society, it had special resonance for the middle class, since it was from precisely this social stratum that the chief custodians of empire, its mid-level military field officers and colonial administrators, were drawn. This, too, undoubtedly contributed to an emotional distance in such families. From the time of their children's birth, parents had to steel themselves to the likelihood that some of their offspring, especially the males, might ship out to a remote outpost of empire, not to be seen again for decades, if ever. It is perhaps not surprising, then, that the British middle-class generation coming of age in the early 1900s was marked by a certain blitheness, so much so that in recalling their growing up many years later, one of Lawrence's brothers could write without a hint of irony, "We had a very happy childhood, which was never marred by a single quarrel between any of us."
That was Lawrence in Arabia by Scott Anderson. Bill Bryson's One Summer, America 1927, takes us on an in-depth journey through a particularly eventful 5 months in American history, May to September 1927. Bryson ensures the obscure, peculiar, and downright fascinating details of this summer are not forgotten, seamlessly weaving them into the events of the big headlines. Charles Lindbergh's solo flight, Babe Ruth's home run streak, and Al Capone's rise to power, to name but a few. It was the year Americans attempted and accomplished outsized things and came of age in a big, brawling manner. What a country, what a summer, and what a story, wonderfully narrated by the author.
It turned out that one of their ground crew, in a moment of excited distraction, had left their canteens filled with soapy water, so they had had nothing to drink for 2 days. Otherwise, the flight was a great success, great enough to be the main story in the New York Times on Good Friday, April 15th. Across 3 columns, the headline declared, "Flyers set record of 51 hours in air, day and night without food or water. Land worn, but eager for Paris flight." They had flown 4,100 miles, 500 miles more than the distance from New York to Paris. Just as significantly, they had managed to get airborne with 375 gallons of fuel, an enormous load for the time, and had used up just 1,200 feet of runway to do so. All this was extremely encouraging for those who wished to fly the Atlantic, and in the spring of 1927 there were many, like Chamberlain and Acosta, who most assuredly did. By a curiously ironic twist, the event that left America far behind the rest of the world in aviation was the very one that assured its dominance in so many other spheres, the First World War. Before 1914, airplanes barely featured in military thinking. The French Air Corps, with 36 planes, was larger than all the other air forces in the world put together. Germany, Britain, Italy, Russia, Japan, and Austria all had no more than 4 planes in their fleets. The United States had just 2. But with the outbreak of fighting, military commanders quickly saw how useful planes could be. For monitoring enemy troop movements, for directing artillery fire, and above all, for providing a new direction and manner in which to kill people. In the early days, bombs often were nothing more than wine bottles filled with gasoline or kerosene, with a simple detonator attached, though a few pilots threw hand grenades, and some for a time dropped specially made darts called flechettes, which could pierce a helmet or otherwise bring pain and consternation to those in the trenches below. As always, where killing is involved, technological progress was swift, and by 1918, aerial bombs of up to 2,200 pounds were being dropped. Germany alone rained down 1 million individual bombs, some 27,000 tons of explosives, in the course of the war. Bombing was not terribly accurate. A bomb dropped from 10,000 feet rarely hit its target, and often missed by 0.5 miles or more. But the psychological effect, wherever a large bomb fell, was considerable. Heavy bomb loads required planes of ever greater size and power, which in turn spurred the development of swifter, nimbler fighter craft to defend or attack them, which in further turn produced the celebrated dogfights that fired the imaginations of schoolboys and set the tone for aviation for a generation to come. The air war produced an insatiable need for planes. In 4 years, the 4 main combatant nations spent $1 billion, a staggering sum, nearly all borrowed from America, on their air fleets. From almost nothing, France in 4 years built up an aircraft industry that employed nearly 200,000 people and produced some 70,000 planes. Britain built 55,000 planes, Germany 48,000, and Italy 20,000. Quite an advance, bearing in mind that only a few years earlier, the entire world aviation industry consisted of 2 brothers in a bicycle shop in Ohio. Up to 1914, the total number of people in the world who had been killed in airplanes was about 100. Now men died in their thousands. By the spring of 1917, the life expectancy of a British pilot was put at 8 days. Altogether, between 30,000 and 40,000 flyers were killed or injured to the point of incapacity in 4 years. Training was not a great deal safer than combat. At least 15,000 men were killed or invalided in accidents in flight schools. American flyers were particularly disadvantaged. When the United States entered the war in April 1917, not a single American military official had ever even seen a fighter aircraft, much less commanded one. When the explorer Hiram Bingham, discoverer of Machu Picchu, but now a middle-aged professor at Yale, offered himself as an instructor, the Army made him a lieutenant colonel and put him in charge of the whole training program, not because he had useful experience. He didn't. But simply because he knew how to fly a plane.
That was One Summer, America 1927 by Bill Bryson. Readers, if I may, I'd like to send a personal salute to my cousin, Major Robert Pasikoff, whose plane was shot down over Laos in 1966 and remains MIA. Our deepest gratitude to all who have served our country and to their families for their sacrifices. Hopefully, you found some titles that have piqued your interest. Need more suggestions? Just check bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.